Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets from the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts, with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. Today on Soundbites, we listen to a panel discussion with cafeteria workers, student activists, farmers, food distributors, and institutional leaders, wrestling with questions on how to transform our food system. Then we'll hear a recipe from Chef Sky Davis. But first, we continue our series of conversations with Winona Howder. Winona Howder is author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. She is also the executive director of Food and Water Watch. Winona is joining us over the next few weeks to talk about the many issues she brings up in her book. Last week, she spoke about how agricultural policy in the 80s and 90s led to deregulation and consolidation of food and agricultural markets. And this week, we dig even deeper into our conversation about those policies. If, in fact, antitrust and reforming trade laws is part of what you're arguing in this book is what has to change, what replaces it? In other words, I mean, it makes me think of an old uncle who would say, when has a store, and he would say, you'd ask him, well, how do you do this? How do you make so much? How do you sell the stuff so cheap? He goes, volume. I mean, that's how I sell things cheaply. So, I mean, because people can buy food relatively inexpensively in America now. Right.
Yes, but, you know, let's look at those statistics, because I think that there's been a lot of controversy, for instance, around Whole Foods CEO John Mackey and some of the things that he's been saying recently.
Because he's a libertarian and was against health care bills, against out of right and all the rest.
Right. Well, he was recorded talking about how cheap food is. He said that Americans have no historical perspective on the price of food. And then he said that the Americans spend about 7% of their income on food. Well, there's a whole mythology around cheap food, and I want to unpack that
a little bit.
Go ahead. So he uses this 7% statistic that's based on a USDA statistic that counts restaurant food, too. The USDA says that Americans spend 9% of their income on food. And we do know that there are some cheap food items. I mean, you can get a burger at a fast food place for a dollar. There are a lot of junk food items that actually are cheap. But when you look at grocery bills for nutritious food or that give people choice, this number that USDA uses is really false. First of all, the USDA averages in that number. They average in all health insurance. This is as disposable income. Health insurance, pension benefits, all food stamps, the Women, Infant, and Children's Program. They average all of those in with the income of everybody in the United States, and then they come up with 9% of the income is spent on food. If you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, to just give this some perspective, mm-hmm. they say that the 40% bottom of Americans spend 36% of their income on food.
36%.
Right. A little over 36%. So your income does matter. And these numbers that are used to show that Americans have cheap food, I don't think most people that are going to the grocery store would say that food is cheap today. Americans are spending. Over the last 10 years, the price of food has gone up 3% every year. And so
that 36% number it reflects the diminishing amount of money that those people are making, so they had to spend more for the food, is what you're saying.
That's right. It matters what your income is, right. And we have increasing stratification in this country. So You know, I just think it's very disrespectful to say that the population only spends 7% of their income on food, and it's simply not true. And some foods are going up a lot more rapidly, some fruits and vegetables and so forth. So this whole argument that we just have cheap food also doesn't count for all of the health costs and all of the impacts of having a food system where 90% of the American dollar is spent on processed food. Now, that said, I do think that a lot of U.S. agriculture policy is directed at producing commodities that are the one of the main ingredients of processed food, and that in the long term, that policy has to change because we have to have a healthier food system that's not as reliant on processed food. Looking at fruits and vegetables, though, and why fruits and vegetables are more expensive and why organic food is more expensive, there's a lot more to it than this quick and dirty answer that it's because farmers are getting subsidized. And when I was writing Foodopoly, I went to the Central Valley of California to try to understand how fruits and vegetables are being grown, how farmers are doing, because we know that since the trade legislation that a lot of farmers have gone out of business. We know crops like asparagus have moved to countries like Peru, and the garlic industry is has moved to China, and that in fact China has become the largest producer of many processed foods. And you can go to the Global Grocer at foodandwaterwatch.org and actually play with your grocery cart and look at fruits and vegetables and where they are being produced now. But what's happened in not just the Central Valley of California, but wherever fruits and vegetables are being produced, and many places, the whole industry has dried up and gone away. What's happened is because such large volume is needed and because of the competition from the developing world, that packers and shippers are much larger and the actual grower has to be much larger. So that consolidation has gone all the way down the food chain to the farm that's growing fruit trees, whether it be citrus or peaches or pecans or almonds. It's true for all of the row crops. Packers and shippers, those are the companies that have the arrangement with the distributor usually. There used to be a lot of different ways that fruits and vegetables got to grocery stores, and we don't have time to go into all of them, but most fruits and vegetables now go through a packer and shipper who makes the deal with the distribution, or which is the distribution company that makes the deal with the grocer. They have to have an international operation. They have to either own a company that operates in some place in the developing world, or they have to have a contract with a company that does. And they have to be very large to have the volume. And they usually now specialize in a few areas. And so all of the profit that farmers, you know, we always hear about how large the farms are in the Central Valley and how profitable it is. Well, they're going out of business and they're being absorbed by larger operations. And that profit is being sucked up the chain, too, because about 12% of the grocery industry's profits come from fruits and vegetables. It's the most profitable center in the grocery store. And companies like Walmart have made it, they need volume, and they need to deal with the very largest companies because to stay in business and deal with Walmart, you know, Walmart is not, it's not just their size and market share, it's the actual logistics that they, logistical system that they use and require. You have to be a large company to use the packaging that they require. A company has to use Walmart's IT system. Walmart has figured out how to suck every bit of profit out of the supply chain, even out of companies like Pepsi and Nestle and the largest food processors, Kowtow to Walmart, which is such a big part of their business. And this is especially true in the produce industry. Now, unfortunately, the sucking of profit from the farm all the way up the supply chain is also going on in the organics industry.
Yeah, you have a whole chapter about the organics, but organics not what we think it is. Before you get there, let me say this question. I mean, could you do talk about, all through the book, about the packaging industry and who buys and how, whether it's the meat industry or whether it's the vegetable industry, and how they call the shots. You talk about a guy in this book who owned the stockyard and was told he could only get X amount of money for this, all the cattle that he had in the stockyard. So he tried to play the same game they did and go back at them. Then they came back and said, well, nobody's going to buy from you. You're stuck.
Yeah.
Because this is what it is. I mean, how did they get there? What is this game being played?
Well, this is why how large you are matters, because these companies have gotten so large that they just wield so much power. And as they've consolidated, farmers don't have any choice about who to sell to. I know I've talked to any number of farmers. When they were kids, if you had some pigs to sell, you probably had four, sometimes as many as six buyers. They'd call up when the pigs were ready to go to market, and maybe you'd be selling them every couple of weeks or as they were finished. And you'd call each of the buyers and you know, play them against one another and see who had the best price. Well, that's all been reversed now. People don't have a choice where to sell to. Even for grains, there's probably one grain elevator. If a farmer is able to use the internet and has figured out the futures market, maybe that farmer will make some money from their crop on the futures market. But, you know, lots of farmers don't want to do that and don't have the skill or the experience to do that. So the market has dried up. I mean, it's just like you're a consumer and you go to the car rental agency, and now I think there are two companies that own all the brands. It looks like there's a lot of choice, but really, these two companies have basically fixed the price. And that's what's happened for farmers. They don't have any choice about the marketplace. That's why we really need to have a review, a backward review of how the consolidation has affected agriculture. And then we're going to have to make it part of the discussion and the debate in society about consolidation, because it's not easy to fix. And I think that that's one of the frustrations that I have with the good food movement is you can't local food your way out of this problem.
That was Winona Halter, and we'll hear more from Winona Halter over the coming weeks. Now we'll listen back to a panel discussion I moderated at Breaking Ground, the Real Food Challenge's second national summit, which was held last weekend at Johns Hopkins University. The roundtable discussion brought together cafeteria workers, student activists, farmers, food distributors, and institutional leaders to explore ways they can challenge and change our food system. We were joined by Sergio Espana, Marie Wilson, Louise Mitchell, Joan Norman, and Zoe Lloyd. Sergio Espana is a longtime Baltimore resident and is a member of the Student Farmworker Alliance Steering Committee. He's currently organizing with the United Workers on a statewide campaign for universal health care. Marie Wilson has worked for 39 years in the food service at Johns Hopkins University. Louise Mitchell is a physical therapist, but she's also the Sustainable Foods Program Manager at Maryland Hospitals for a Healthy Environment and the Regional Organizer for a Healthy Food in Healthcare Programs, Healthcare Without Harm, which brings local, sustainable, and healthy food into healthcare facilities throughout the state. Joan Norman, who along with her husband Drew, farms organic crops at One Straw Farm in Maryland. They founded it in 1983. It's one of the oldest and largest organic farms in the state. They also run it as the largest Food Alliance certified vegetable farm in the state, serving customers through six farmers markets and a 2,000-member CSA. Zoe Lloyd is local sales coordinator for Common Market Philadelphia, a food distributor working with organic and sustainable farms throughout Pennsylvania. But we start off with Louise Mitchell. The reason I want to start with you is because you have, through the organization you've been working with, really been a leader and beginning the movement to change foods from our local institutions, changing foods in our hospitals. And I think most people would be shocked to kind of even think about and understand that most of the food served in local hospitals is neither sustainable nor necessarily healthy. Give us a bit of your story and how that fits into the question.
Changing institutional food, as you all know, and why you're here, is a big undertaking and has many challenges. And it's actually almost inconceivable to most of us, probably, that the food is the way it is in our institutions, especially hospitals, of any of the institutions where you think that healthy food should be. And I see it as kind of the way our culture has moved, and everyone's moved that direction, including hospitals where you'd think that they might know better to serve, you know, to kind of stick with the healthier foods and not let the other outside influences change their food environment. And so we've been working with hospitals through our program, Maryland Hospitals for Healthy Environment, for the past 6.5 years. It's part of a broader initiative to incorporate sustainability initiatives into healthcare. It's been working. It's a slow and steady process, and there are challenges, but it's absolutely and completely doable. And there are many, many changes that are happening.
So when we say it's doable, I mean, take it from and doable is a huge word. I mean, one of the things we learned in some of the programs we've been doing over the last couple of years on Soundbites, sister, you just take the state of Maryland, that the combined food budget for all the public school systems in the state of Maryland is $1 billion or more, which could have a huge economic effect, an effect on the farming system, if that money was spent in a different way. Mm-hmm. So, and Sergio, you've been organizing for a while. And talk a bit about the work you're doing and how that fits into this.
Sure, yeah. So I'm kind of all over the place in terms of work that I've been doing over the years. But I think specifically here, I'm actually going to still be all over the place because I feel that these connections are important, and it's important for us to recognize that when we're fighting for real food, or when we're fighting for living wages for folks that are working in the food industry, it's connected to a broader economic and cultural system. And you know, by us taking on this nugget of it, it helps us to actually build a much larger part. So I actually wanted to be really cheesy and kind of what helps speak to that is this quote from Dr. King that really kind of shapes the work that we do. Both with the Student Farm Worker Alliance, Coalition of Mockley Workers, and United Workers here in Baltimore. And it's this quote that was written that he said before the Poor People's Campaign in the 60s. And it said, quote, "The dispossessed of this nation, the poor, both white and Negro, live in a cruelly unjust society. They must organize against the injustice, not against the lives of the persons who are their fellow citizens, but against the structures through which the society is refusing to take means which have been called for and which are at hand to lift the load of poverty. There are millions of poor people in this country who have very little or even nothing to lose. If they can be helped to take action together, they will do so with a freedom and a power that will be a new and unsettling force in our complacent national life." And so that quote is kind of speaks to the kind of vision that we work towards with the Student Farm Worker Alliance and CIW in terms of what we do is we're, you know, as allies to the Student Farm Worker Alliance, it's to help build and empower those who are very directly affected. And so what they've been doing for the past 20 years has been organizing themselves and really showing that they can take charge of the situation and doing this while connecting with the consumer base around the country. So in terms of, you know, y'all here, you've been actually a very instrumental part in this, where students have been able to very directly target, food systems. As Mark pointed out, I mean, $1 billion is quite a chunk of money. Folks are going to listen to those who are, you know, who are correct, who are paying for that money to make sure that it reflects what's necessary so that it can be in place. And so through that, students have been able to take on campaigns of by being consumers, by targeting their local food distributors. They've been able to win campaigns against Taco Bell, McDonald's, Burger King, et cetera, by basically saying, hey, you know, like, all we're asking is a penny more per pound of tomato. You know, if you do that, I mean, yeah, we'll keep, you know, I mean, we like, you know, I don't know why, but a lot of folks still like chalupas. It does make some sense. But I think more importantly for us in our work, it isn't just about like what kind of a role do we have as consumers, but it's the kind of movement that we've been building, I think, is what's been really instrumental, where it hasn't been our relationship as consumers or as students, but it's been the fact that we've recognized that we are part of a food cycle, that we are part of an integral part of that chain of the economic system, and then also just of the way the food works. You know, we're composed of food, you know, and we make it. So seeing how we can build that unity together, both in terms of the food system, but then also in terms of the empowerment that comes from working from by crossing these cultural divides and crossing these class divides and building a movement that way has been extremely inspiring, both for the folks working in the fields and then for folks around the country who have recognized that that we do have power. It's a lot more than just whether or not we, you know, we boycott one thing or another. It's the fact that we recognize that we are agents of change and that we can work with folks from different communities to, you know, manifest a better world.
So, and Zoe, I mean, I'd like you to talk a minute about the work you do at Common Market. People might not know what that is, and describe that, and especially how it fits into what we've heard so far.
So we work with sustainable growers in the kind of greater Delaware Valley region, and we distribute to institutions and retailers, grocery stores in that same region, mainly in Philadelphia, within probably about 50 miles of Philadelphia. But we are hopefully expanding to Baltimore within a couple of months, so we're very excited about that. So we, you know, our mission is twofold, is really to strengthen regional farms, and also to increase access to of that farm food to institutions and the communities they serve. So, you know, just to talk a little bit about what Luis said, so we work with institutions, large food service companies, mainly a lot of them that work at hospitals, at colleges and universities. We work with them to try to help them figure out, you know, what are the local products that you can use to integrate into your menu to, you know, get the sustainable local food to be serving healthier meals to their students. And then we also work with farmers on the other end. I actually work with farmers more so. I do the purchasing. And so we work to identify farms that are growing sustainably, that are treating their workers fairly. We actually have a questionnaire that we go through with our farmers to kind of understand their growing methods, whether they're using chemicals, whether they're using IPM, integrated pest management, what kinds of relationships they have with their farm workers. These are really kind of challenges and challenging questions to ask, but we kind of partner with our growers in the region to kind of identify what their needs are and to figure out how we provide them with access to these markets.
Anne-Marie, talk about, I'm curious for you to talk, describe for a moment, before we turn to Joan Norman, the changes you've seen in 39 years of working at Johns Hopkins and Food Service, because you talked a bit earlier before we even started this, how the change you've seen.
When I first came here, it was in 1974. The food was far better than what we're actually seeing now. Basically, the taste is different now. Back then, I could get fresh rolls. You could actually smell the rolls when you're coming in a cafeteria. The students used to love that. You know, fresh string beans. You know, they would get the fresh string beans. They're freshly cut. Nothing was near processed like it is now. And basically, I'm really in this joint for sustainable food because that's what I strive to give my family every day. I have a daughter who went away to college, and she called me every weekend, "Ma, I need to come home to get fresh food." Oh, she said, because when it comes down to it, I'm tired of eating all this greasy food. The processed food, she said, the taste is nothing like from home. So being that I work here, I see the students every day, and my overall goal is to see that they get the closest, get the best food as close to as to what they get at home. And I think that's the home-cooked meals, and everybody strives to go home on the Christmas break, the Thanksgiving break, to get those fresh home-cooked meals.
So Marina, let me ask this. When you said you've seen these changes in the last 39 years, what do you think happened? I mean, what happened when you started working there and you saw the fresh cut vegetables, you saw the fresh rolls? What happened?
I think that over time they've learned to do things faster, more processed, more quick stuff. You use the instant potatoes instead of the fresh cut potatoes. You know, you get the bread out of the package instead of the fresh made bread. And it's a faster pace, you know, you don't need as many workers. You know, you can cut back on your hours, and because that works, that's what seemed to be the right thing to do. It's the really the wrong thing to do, but they see that this is the right thing to do, the people who pass this food off to the students. I eat the same food every day that you all eat. I'm basically sick of it. You know, basically, you come in, you look at the same food every day. You're like, well, I actually say I can't wait to get home. And I know that you all are actually here every day. You can't just go home like I go home every day. You know, a lot of times I go home and I pray to God that something changes. You know, because it's truly not right. It's not right. You pay more money now than what I've seen students pay back in when I came in 74, but you're not getting as quality food.
That was Marie Wilson, and you're listening to Soundbites on Dharmava, and I'm your host, Mark Steiner. We have to take a very short break, but don't go away. When we come back from this break, we'll hear more about how members of our panel are working to transform our food system and how it gets to our institutions and what they do with it. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and this is Soundbites on Dharmava. Today, we listen back to a panel discussion I moderated at Breaking Ground, Real Food Challenge's second national summit. The roundtable discussion brought together cafeteria workers, student activists, farmers, food distributors, and institutional leaders to explore ways that they can change our food system. So let's jump right back into our conversation. So I'm curious. Here we have the components out in front of us. The students who are challenging the system, in many ways, the food challenge. And we have people challenging institutions, who work in the institutions, who are organizing workers, trying to figure out how to distribute the services and grow, and the farmer who grows the food. So, and I was thinking about what you said at the end, Marie, about change and how people and how we have to come together to make this happen. So how does it happen? I mean, so you all are out there struggling in your own universities to change the nature of food inside the systems you have to live in, right? So how does this really come together in a way that really changes? I mean, can you build, let me start this way, do you think you can actually build a system where the majority of the food is grown by the one-straw farms of our world? What'd you say?
I said, I can only hope. I would love to sell everybody the food.
You know, is there a system that distributes it? Can workers be given a living wage? One of the things I thought about as you were talking was that part of it is you're never going to have everybody eating healthy food unless people have a living wage to buy the healthy food, right? Make it more mass. So talk about all your visions about how this begins. How does this begin to come together?
I mean, basically, in the world I work in, which is in the cafeterias, you have to educate the workers, you have to educate the student, and you have to educate the people who bring the food in. And I think when you bring all three of those groups of people together to get an understanding of actually how this thing works, you'll probably have a lot of people with questions, you'll have a lot of people with answers, and you'll have a lot of people who are actually learning. And when you bring them all together, I think it can make the system work.
I think we've already been doing education for years and years, and you know what? Everybody knows they're supposed to eat, you know, 5 vegetables a day, and nobody does it. It's not about that. All my friends are well-educated, they have plenty of money, and they're not eating well either. So it is not about education. The thing that we've all missed is about desire. What do you want? What is sexy? What is the thing that I desire to do? And what we haven't done is made eating well a desirable event. I think that desire part and the sexy part of it all is where we need to start. You can change kids, I think, immediately. I think you can change your neighbors. I think you can take your roommates who don't think eating well, you know, eating well is an important thing. They can eat whatever they want because it's there. And I think once that starts being created, we can change anything once people want it. So we need to make it sexy, we need to make it desirable, and then it'll be sort of easy.
At Maryland Hospitals for a Healthy Environment, we take a multi-pronged approach. So we do all of what you've been saying. So one is bringing people together to learn from one another, sharing best practices, actually getting into the details on how they actually started buying local food from a farmer. Did they have to go get, you know, some kind of approval? Did they look at, you know, see if there was some certificate or some, USDA certification that they had to be able to buy direct from a farmer? So bringing food service directors and purchasers together to learn from one another. We do educate them about the issues. We also educate them about cost-saving strategies. One of the certainly a real challenge is cost, but it's also a perceived challenge that it's a barrier, because if you start to, for example, reduce the meat on your menu, you can shift to buying better, more sustainable meat and actually still come out with a balanced budget. So, and there are tons of, there are a lot of different strategies and ideas for starting to make these small little changes that actually show food service directors and purchasing managers that it's doable, and it takes small steps. That's another key ingredient is, small steps. Look for the low-hanging fruit. Look for things that are easy places to start. Changing the food environment is really big. When you make the healthiest choice the easiest choice, either by placement strategies, that's what's in front, you know, we've got fruit bowl at the cash register, not the chocolate bars, by pricing incentives. So at hospitals, they've started increasing the price of French fries and decreasing the price at the salad bar. It's working really well, and they don't have no changes in their budget. They balance the budget, so you can do price incentives, and that, again, helps make the healthiest choice the easiest choice. You can also, like, we know that the kind of the easy, another easy place to start is the coffee. You can always add a line of fair trade coffee or organic coffee to the, you know, line that you're serving already. The coffee vendors all have access to that. And I'm just thinking of any other easy places that to start. We have a food leadership council where we bring people together, and we've actually opened it up so it's not just for healthcare. And we actually had Johns Hopkins University on our food leadership council. We had meetings here, and they started working with their contractors to start buying local sustainable chicken. They were like very seriously looking into it. There was a cost factor, obviously, especially with chicken being the highest, probably the highest meat purchase that they made on their menu. And then the other thing that's worked really well for us is campaigns. And you guys know about campaigns. So we in Maryland, there's the Buy Local campaign, Buy Local Challenge. And it was started by a nonprofit in Southern Maryland. And now the governor adopted it, the Maryland Department of Agriculture. And so the last week of July, it's called the Buy Local Challenge. You make a pledge to eat one local food every day for a week. Well, I took the campaign and I said, okay, let's adapt it to hospitals. And so we created the Buy Local campaign for hospitals to engage them to purchase and serve at least one local food every day for a week and promote the farmers, identify which farms they are, put little signs at the point of sale. We gave them tools and resources that help make it easy to promote posters, things that are already made, you know, that fit on an Avery postcard, you know, thing you put in the printer so it's nice and quick, easy. That really helps them because they're busy. They have to fit this into their kind of regular job to, you know, kind of manage the food service department. So making it easy, fun. So with the Buy Local Challenge, they would commit to serving at least one local food. And then we also had them start to sign up their employees and patients and then give them recognition. That's the other thing that works really, really well. When you recognize them and celebrate their successes, they get more engaged. It's fun. They feel rewarded. They don't feel criticized or put down. They feel like, yeah, this is good. I want to do more. And then they're willing to do another step. And it's going to take time. You have to be patient. But that's how we've really made a lot of success in our approach.
So I'm curious, we all are from all across the region, right? So I'm curious if you to jump up. Is that the mic we're using over here? To kind of tell your own experiences and to talk about how this relates to the work you're doing.
I can keep talking. I would just really love to hear from
you. I want to hear from the students out here, too. Yeah.
I've been organizing at American University, and we found a really effective tool to organizing the whole community together and following like a social movement union organizing strategy opposed to like a business model strategy or a strategy where everyone's kind of separate but working together. It's finding the shared interests amongst the faculty, the students, the greater community, and the workers. So for us, it's been really effective building like one-on-one relationships, like one student and one worker. And for our campaign specifically, we found out that like there'd be random days where like a whole bunch of the students would get sick and nobody knew why, but they all ate in the cafeteria. And then the workers would be like, oh, well, so-and-so got reprimanded at work because they were serving expired food and we weren't allowed to take it off, so it had to get served. So that was like a really amazing breakthrough in communication because that united the entire community and people were really mad. So everyone was like, no, like our workers need whistleblower protection for their sanity and their dignity and we need it for our health. And then in the contract, the workers won the whistleblower protection. So really like thinking about what the shared interests are, is really important for that aspect, but it's also important so you can like recognize the different privileges that people come into the fight with.
That's important. Zoe, about
so we're talking a lot about barriers and barriers to how do we get real food? How is it accessible to institutions like Johns Hopkins and other universities? So I think something we haven't really talked about, we talked a lot about workers on the farm, workers in food service. The other thing is, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but seasonal availability, I feel like, is really a barrier, especially with farms, in this region growing. Well, I'm not sure what the growing season is here, but in Pennsylvania, it's not very long, right? And so kind of working with farmers and working with institutions to figure out, okay, what makes most sense in terms of how do we buy local during this time of year? We work with farmers to get them to store root crops that are available throughout the year for institutions like hospitals and universities. And we also work on the other end with institutions to figure out a way. Okay, we distribute lots of products: we dairy, eggs, meats, cheeses. So, what are some animal products that you could incorporate into your menu, like eggs, like cage-free eggs, or certified lean turkey, or some cheeses. So we work with them to kind of figure out. Well, we found that the food service companies we work with that are successful in doing this are incorporating maybe 2 to 3. Staple items like eggs, for instance, or turkey. We have a school, George School, run by Cullinart, a food service company we work with in Philadelphia, and a lot of accounts, and they're really active and want to incorporate this local food, and so they've been successful, and they order tons of eggs from us, and they figured out a way to incorporate into their menu so that their food costs, their plate costs are in line, and. And they also, they do this other amazing thing, actually. We work with farmers that have, farmers have, in retail stores, they have number one product, right? It looks beautiful. There's a lot of waste going on there, right? Which is a whole other issue we're not talking about here, but food waste. But they have number two products, like, that don't look quite perfect or, they can't sell them, right? And so we actually work with some farmers, this Amish farm, and he had number two tomatoes he couldn't sell. And so he sold, maybe 500 pounds or 1,000 pounds of tomatoes to the school, George School, throughout the summer, and they made tomato sauce from it. They froze it and they had it throughout the whole year. So it's kind of a way in which we work with farmers and institutions to try to bridge that seasonal availability on both ends. And so we found, like I said, successful institutions kind of. They kind of find a couple products that they order consistently, and then they can get local produce when it's in season, and then when it's not, or when it's not affordable, that they don't. So that's what we found. And I don't know, if you guys have experiences with it, the food service directors that they've incorporated certain things or what. So I'd like to hear from some of you guys.
Hi, I'm actually based at the University of Maryland. And I've gotten the privilege to be involved with a lot of different initiatives on my campus. I think someone's from Maryland University. basically, one of the biggest things I noticed, relating to the overall, just the strength of campaigns and how to get things off the ground, is sort of the desire to get it going. And when you guys are talking a little bit about desire versus education, where's the first step? To me, I'm really more of education to that. But to me, more than anything, basically, it seems to me with a lot of different campus organizations, a lot of different campaigns and things like that, as we discussed earlier, a lot of it is really precipiced on every 4 years or so, some students step up and become very large leaders. But what happens after these students leave? So to me, I've tried to do a lot to think about what is the way to build a culture of this on campus? What are the steps you take? Because there's things that students can do, and students can make great accomplishments in 4 years, 3 years, however much time they're there, but it won't mean anything if someone just leaves. And also balancing that same work with the fact that as students working, we're students, we have our classes, we have our internships, we have everything. We're also between 18 and 21, and we're supposed to be having a lot of fun and such like that, so we can get distracted a lot. But basically taking all of this into account, basically, not just, I don't really want to call it the constraints of being the student. I want to say sort of the unique standard of being a student at a university. How, do you guys think, seeing, how students work and how, to make a long-lasting culture across campus is, what's sort of, the unique, focus point of this so that we can do something that extends beyond 4 years to 10 years to 20 for forever? So
that's a really important question. I think that, part of it, it would be a good way to kind of wrap this up in that way, in the sense that the real food challenge that we're here talking about, that's what it's about. right? It's about how to start things on campus to change things, uniting with workers in those campuses, working with local farmers. But that means it has to transfer to the next people coming in and moving the organization so it becomes larger. So how does that happen? What form does that take? Marie, go ahead.
I was thinking when you were talking, it's like how they form groups for other organizations, and those groups stay once the four-year student leaves and another group comes in. You recruit these people maybe in your third or fourth year, or have somebody in the group that recruits other people to come into where you left, if you understand what I'm saying. You know, basically, if I go into a college today and it's a sustainable food group, and those people come out, they've moved on, but somebody else needs to be recruited into their spot. So the college itself can offer this group all the time, and other, new people will come in. I don't know if I explained myself right, but.
No, food sorority and a food fraternity.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, right.
That's a good idea.
And I would stress, just echoing that, you got to be working on outreach constantly and building this up. Like our student group at UMBC, after we were done, it's actually funny, Stephanie's in the room right now, who works with Mark, and she was the part of the next generation of folks after we graduated. That group's maintained itself to some extent for like around 7 or so years right now, and it's been because of this emphasis on leadership development, and that it's not just like a specific project and seeing it through, but it's about the fact that they're how do we maintain and promote a specific culture of social action and empowerment, and I mean that's just like that tends to be pretty interesting to folks. So if you just have that message and you constantly focus on outreach, you'll always find folks that want to plug in. You just got to make it a part of your mission.
So the organization, whatever you build on campus, has to be sustained, and that's why you can keep it united with whether it's distributors or farmers or workers. To even see it serious is if that is sustained beyond just your 2, 3, 4 years in the place you're on. Go ahead, and then
Where you form the group on your campus, say like here at Johns Hopkins, if they form the group, everybody in Maryland that attends a certain college and this is the program they're looking for, they all need to band together here. And in whatever other state they have it, they all band together in that particular state. And at some point in time, they may have where they all have this one thing where they all meet up together to see if it's working for them.
Yeah, right. Louise, and then we'll go back to the audience.
Well, that's what this is, right? Today's the regional day, and then tomorrow and Sunday are your national coming together. So that's exactly what this is. So establishing traditions as well, so that, you know, are kind of done annually. So Earth Day, obviously, really great opportunity to engage and do some activities. Food Day now, with October 24th is Food Day. That's an even bigger opportunity, especially for this group, to really move that along. Legislative Day, in every state, there's a legislative session that lasts usually 3 months, give or take. And there's also federal legislation. So some kind of annual getting students down to Annapolis, getting signing on. Right now there's several bills, and you were Sergio was talking about one. There's pesticide legislation to sign on to. There are two antibiotics bills to sign on to in Maryland. Food and Water Watch probably has information on their table about it. And you can do that electronically, but you can also go down there. You can get others to sign on. Those kinds of things are also helpful as far as changing policy. And then this kind of notion of campaigns or events or something along that line that becomes a tradition for that group that you've been talking about.
Rachel. I'm the co-founder and president of Real Food Hopkins, which is a student group on campus that's involved in these issues. And I'd say like the biggest things that we found are success is making traditions. We started the 100 mile meal 3 years ago. And last year we had 140 people. Our first one, we had 70. So it's amazing how much it's growing and more people look forward to it each year. And that's like something that can sustain a culture of like traditional foods and trying to get people to think about where their meals are coming from. But also working into university policy, because right now we're in the contract year, trying to determine who our next provider will be, and going to meetings, lots and lots of meetings, debating the different proposals that are coming in, but having influence just from getting student opinions, going to different campuses, seeing what their providers provide, coming back here and saying, could you include this in the proposal, and things like that. So even if we don't get everything we want, incorporating little things into university policy so that even once we leave, those will be in the policy forever, or at least for 7 or 8 years.
And are people coming into your organization who are like freshmen, people coming in and joining now?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely people always all the time emailing, and a couple freshmen were really lucrative in helping make this event possible as well. So they're behind the scenes right now or in classes because we don't have today off. But, yeah, so there's definitely underclassmen that are coming up and rising. So.
All right. Thank you. So I think it's about time to conclude the panel. We got more stuff coming up behind us, I know. And I'm just curious from final thoughts about what, especially, you know, I was thinking, Louise, I mean, your work is ongoing in your institution. I mean, you're pushing these hospitals. And I wonder how you think all think this, what we've talked about, especially those of you who are not part of this Real Food Challenge, but are just either on the periphery of it or were invited here just to be on this panel, how this fits in to what you're doing at Maryland or what you're pushing in terms of trying to push down to beyond the distribution work you're doing in Pennsylvania and how does this fit in? Does it?
Well, one final thought is, you know, it's slow, steady steps. So I don't know if any of you have had that experience so far, but that's you're kind of buckle up for the long ride, and it's, you know, it's going to be kind of a slow, steady process. You can obviously influence your own food environment and your own food choices, and maybe those around you in a, you know, tight circle, but this change is going to be, it takes time, and just knowing that and coming together with people that are of like mind certainly helps keep you guys energized and moving, you know, continue to move forward and not get discouraged that when it's not changing faster than you'd like it to.
I think you should look at this and say, okay, I was in college 30 years ago at the University of Maryland, and the food was not so great. But the fact that all of you are sitting here is a huge step, and I think if you think of the goal is your children going to college and this not being an issue, you'll know your success. So you have another, you know, 20 or 30 years, and all of a sudden, if it's not a big deal anymore, you've done a great job. You know, it may take that long, but it's okay.
I think it's admirable that you guys are here and you're fighting for this, and I think it's really, really important. I was just thinking about what Sergio was saying about these structures and how there's this movement to kind of reshape this whole food system structures, right? The economic structures, the social structures, and how in order to do that, we need to understand how those structures exist and not necessarily, I mean, you're fighting against them, but you're fighting to change them, to shape them, right? And so it's a fight, but it's also like, it's also you need to work within those structures in order to change them. And that's what we found. I mean, we work with large food service companies. We may be working with Aramark, but we are working to change the way that they interact with their universities, their institutions. You know, we're you know, excited to be working with, you know, universities that already have, like Bon Appetit, that already they buy 20% local. Like, that's great. But we also want to change how these large food service companies work, you know, changing these structures. But you can't necessarily just fight them. You have to like work to reshape them. And I think that's a lot of what you're talking about. So I guess that's kind of what I'm thinking is a good takeaway. So.
Quick take, Sergio.
What folks have been saying, just stressing that, just, you know, as students, you have an awful lot of power. And I would also encourage you all to really think, definitely how to build a legacy within your schools that maintains itself, and also how to use the resources there. You can really milk. I mean, they're charging you an arm and a leg to get you in debt for most of your life. The very least you can do is try to do as much as possible the same thing. They're sitting on a whole bunch of money that they take from you and from loans that you're borrowing. And you should use that and put it to, you know, support social action in your communities and support organizations that are doing similar work. And then also just recognize that you're not just going to be students. You know, you're going to graduate, and then what are you going to be doing afterwards? And this isn't just like a section of life in which you can kind of dabble in this stuff. This is a process in which you're developing this leadership and share it with other folks. You know, like, you have that responsibility.
Myself, we can become cynical about these kinds of things. I know I do. There's so many barriers and challenges, but you need to stay positive in order to make this happen, right? It has to happen, so you have to stay positive. Okay, there's lots of things going on that you're working towards, and like Louise said, like baby steps. Like, we found, like, things happen slowly, and that's okay, but like, just stay positive about it.
And let me finish up.
How does this final word is keep pushing. I'm going to keep pushing. I've been in the food service for 39 years, and if I get 39 more, I'm going to still be there. And my thought is that if you keep moving and keep knowing that this is what you want, it'll work.
All right.
No doubt, I believe it can happen.
Okay. Thank you all. Chef Sky Davis is a vegan and raw food chef, a nutritional consultant, a doula, and a natural lifestyle coach. She used to own and run the Yaba Pot, a vegetarian restaurant in Baltimore, but has since moved to Puerto Rico, where she runs a wellness retreat program called Paradise Wellness and owns the Roots and Fruits Vegan Juice Bar. She joined us to share one of her seasonal recipes and to talk about some of the benefits of the raw diet.
It's a curry pumpkin and chickpea dish. The pumpkin that I'm using could also be substituted for, like, acorn squash, which is seasonal. So basically you're going to need one small pumpkin, not the Halloween-type pumpkins, but we call it calabash here in Puerto Rico, but up there you can use acorn squash. And then three cans of chickpeas and one onion. Three cloves of garlic, preferably a tablespoon of whole cumin seeds. If not, you can use a tablespoon of ground cumin. About an inch and a half of whole ginger root, some oil, curry powder. I use about 2 heaping tablespoons and salt. First, saute the onions very lightly. I don't want any to burn, so I just do like a light saute. While I'm doing that, I throw in the onions, let them cook down a little. I open the cans of chickpeas, and I throw them in even with the water. I throw the cumin, the ginger, the two tablespoons of curry, and I cut up the acorns or pumpkin into cubes, put that in, and salt, and just let it cook all the way down until the pumpkin is soft. And that's it. So if someone can just add more raw to their life, which is eat more fruit, like for breakfast, eat a salad for lunch, et cetera, then they are going to benefit by eating by the raw food diet. Even if they eat a cooked meal for dinner, just by incorporating those things during breakfast and lunch, they're going to just benefit 75% more of their life. The big part is you're getting more water in your system and more enzymes. You know, every time you cook your food, you're actually dehydrating the food because the water is coming out of it. And so people are like, don't have enough water in their system. That's the big benefit, is getting more water in their system. And the enzymes, getting those enzymes in is really important, because folks, as soon as they start eating 100% raw or just a lot more raw, they get more energy, because our body is being depleted of enzymes because they're being killed through cooking food.
That was Chef Sky Davis. And if you have any seasonal recipes you want to share, please send them to soundbitesradio@gmail.com. And let us interview you and get your recipes and you on our show. And that's all we have time for today. I'd like to thank all of our guests, Winona Howder, Sergio Espana, Marie Wilson, Louise Mitchell, Joan Norman, Zoe Lloyd, and Sky Davis. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.